Okay, welcome to Evening Under Lamplight, the show that invites you to attend. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and this is Community Radio in Cambridge, Cambridge 105. The seasons are changing and our lives are constantly adjusting to all the new things that come our way each day, each minute, in fact. But here's something you can rely on, Evening Under Lamplight, every fourth Sunday. And thank you, Patrick, for the hour's worth before this. Now, what do we have for you this evening under lamplight? After two relatively heavy but also light-filled shows on the Einoma concept, I was looking around for a different kind of topic, and then I had a request from a friend who wanted to hear that show I did over 3 years ago on 209 Radio about children. She used it for the postgraduate class she was teaching in child psychology, and I was flattered that the show was so used. And now she asked if it could be available to some students now. So, in an unusual move, I decided to revise that older show and bring you this evening, under lamplight, a show called Children, Second Edition. Let's start with a charming little song by Donovan, Little Boy in Corduroy, from that period when Donovan seemed immersed in nursery rhythms and childlike themes, much to the scorn of more mature people. But as you attend to this song, try to catch the way he uses the simplicity of lyric and tune as the occasion for all sorts of jazzy playfulness. It's actually a more sophisticated song than it may at first appear.
Little boy in corduroy, little girl in lace, a little coy jump for joy, colour in the space. Little boy in corduroy, after me say, how many wishes can you wish in a day? Sunny wish for a rainy day.
Save a sunny wish for a rainy day.
I wish I had a wish away.
Donovan, we know, was badly burned by the cutthroat world of pop stardom, and here's his attempt to capture the innocence of childhood. A little fey, perhaps, but I continue to find this tune catchy and uplifting. And after all, what can be wrong with lines like, "How many wishes can you wish in a day?" I'll bet you've never considered this question before. And then, I wish I had a wish to wish a wish away. Now, probably the most important writer about childhood, at least in English, was William Wordsworth, one of the first to propose that children perceive the world differently from adults. Before him, children were just regarded as diminutive adults. Their clothes were just smaller copies of what their parents wore, and childhood was a time simply for training them in the duties and manners expected of them as soon as they were competent. But no, Wordsworth said, children have a special relationship with the world, especially the world of nature, which we should nurture and allow them room to enjoy. The spontaneous, unself-conscious, non-intellectual apprehension of the world is not some immature deficiency, but has a virtue of its own. Children are closer to the wonder and divinity in the world, and if we can allow them to feel the presence of wonder and divinity, they are more likely to grow up into generous, compassionate adults. Wordsworth himself was constantly going back to the deep feelings nature had awoken in him when he was a child in the Lake District, and this soothed and encouraged him in his periods of trouble and despair. The theme of the development from child to adult forms the heart of many of Wordsworth's most important poems. And this evening, let's look at one of the early poems, Anecdote for Fathers, a poem with the interesting subtitle, Showing How the Art of Lying May Be Taught. The point is that we may very well encourage our children to become liars if we try too hard to make them act like adults. The poem is in a ballad format, telling a simple story of a father out for a walk with his beloved 5-year-old son on a beautiful morning. Weighing one thing against another, involved with regrets and hopes, we get the impression that something bad, maybe the death of the mother, had happened the previous year that caused them to move from Kilve on the Somerset coast to an inland farm at Lyswin. The father asks the son which place he likes better. The son gives a quick answer. The father presses him again and again to express a reason for his choice until the child makes up some silly answer just so he doesn't disappoint his father. But let's hear how Wordsworth puts it. Anecdote for Fathers. I have a boy of 5 years old. His face is fair and fresh to see. His limbs are cast in beauty's mould, and dearly he loves me. One morn we strolled on our dry walk, our quiet house all full in view, and held such intermitted talk as we were wont to do. My thoughts on former pleasures ran. I thought of Kilve's delightful shore, our pleasant home when spring began a long, long year before. A day it was when I could bear to think and think and think again. With so much happiness to spare, I could not feel a pain. My boy was by my side, so slim and graceful in his rustic dress, and oftentimes I talked to him in very idleness. The young lambs ran a pretty race, the morning sun shone bright and warm. Kilve, I said, was a pleasant place, and so is Lyswin Farm. My little boy, which like you more, I said, and took him by the arm. Our home by Kilve's delightful shore, or here at Lyswin Farm? Oh, and tell me, had you rather be, I said, and took him by the arm, on Kilve's smooth shore by the green sea, or here at Lyswin Farm? In careless mood he looked at me, while still I held him by the arm, and said, at Kilve I'd rather be than here at Lyswin Farm. Now, little Edward, say, why so? My little Edward, tell me, why? I cannot tell, I do not know. Why, this is strange, said I, for here are woods and green hills warm. There surely must some reason be why you would change sweet Lyswin Farm for Kilve by the green sea. At this my boy, so fair and slim, hung down his head, nor made reply. And five times did I say to him, "Why, Edward, tell me, why?" His head he raised. There was in sight, it caught his eye, he saw it plain, upon the housetop, glittering bright, a broad and gilded vane. Then did the boy his tongue unlock, and eased his mind with this reply, "At Kilve there was no weathercock, and that's the reason why." Oh, dearest, dearest boy, my heart for better lore would seldom yearn, could I but teach the hundredth part of what from thee I learn. And what did the father learn from Edward? He learned that he'd pushed his son too far. Children do not care about choosing which is the better place to live, much less giving well-thought-out reasons for their choice. They are involved in the present moment, and abstractions like judging what makes one place better than another simply does not concern them. Why does the boy say he prefers Kilve to Lizen? I think he looks up and sees a weathercock or weather vane on a building near them and just seizes on that as his reason. Well, at Kilve there was no weathercock, he blurts out. Anything just to please his father. Is it a truthful answer? Is it a lie? The child doesn't care. Such distinctions do not matter. He's interested in more immediate things, like just holding his father's hand as they walk along. The fact that Wordsworth chooses the weather vane is significant, too. We adults are always looking for meaning and for labels. Is the wind blowing? Well, that's enough for the child, who will delight in the sound and feel of the wind and the sight of the trees being swept back and forth. All this wonder. Adults, however, want to know what direction the wind's coming from. Will the wind bring rain? Check the weather vane to see if the wind is coming from the east or the west. Now, there's nothing wrong with our need to put labels on things and look for causes and effects, but we have to realize that this kills our sense of wonder, and it is not the way a child will naturally look at the world.
Here I go again.
Of course, when we talk about childhood innocence and wonder, we have to bring in the Fraggles, especially my dear Moki Fraggle, who so delicately here asks why. Stevenson took Wordsworth's ideas a little further in his 1878 essay Child's Play, an essay still cited as significant by child psychologists. People speak of how imaginative children are, but Stevenson suggests they're not really imaginative in the way we usually understand the term. Their imagination always needs to act out what it makes up, not like the adult's imagination, which can exist purely in the mind. Here's how he puts it. We grown people can tell ourselves a story and give and take strokes until the bucklers ring, ride far and fast, marry, fall, and die, all the while sitting quietly by the fire or lying prone in bed. This is exactly what a child cannot do, or does not do at least, when he can find anything else. He works all with lay figures and stage properties. When his story comes to the fighting, he must rise, get something by way of a sword, and have a set to with a piece of furniture until he is out of breath. When he comes to ride with the king's pardon, he must bestride a chair which he will so hurry and belabor, and on which he will so furiously demean himself that the messenger will arrive, if not bloody with spurring, at least fiery red with haste. If his romance involves an accident upon a cliff, he must clamber in person about the chest of drawers and fall bodily upon the carpet before his imagination is satisfied. Lead soldiers, dolls, all toys, in short, are in the same category and answer the same end. Nothing can stagger a child's faith. He accepts the clumsiest substitutes and can swallow the most staring incongruities. The chair he has just been besieging as a castle or valiantly cutting to the ground as a dragon is taken away for the accommodation of a mourning visitor, and he's nothing abashed. He can skirmish by the hour with a stationary coal scuttle. In the midst of the enchanted pleasance, he can see, without sensible shock, the gardener soberly digging potatoes for the day's dinner. He can make abstraction of whatever does not fit into his fable, and he puts his eyes into his pocket just as we would hold our noses in an unsavory lane. And so it is that although the ways of children cross with those of their elders in 100 places daily, they never go in the same direction, nor so much as lie in the same element. In the child's world of dim sensation, play is all in all. Making believe is the gist of his whole life, and he cannot so much as take a walk except in character. I could not learn my alphabet without some suitable mise-en-scene, and I had to act a businessman in an office before I could sit down to my book. Will you kindly question your memory and find out how much you did, work or pleasure, in good faith and soberness, and for how much you had to cheat yourself with some invention? I remember, as though it were yesterday, the expansion of spirit, the dignity and self-reliance that came with a pair of mustachios in burnt cork, even when there was none to see. Children are even content to forego what we call the realities and prefer the shadow to the substance. When they might be speaking intelligibly together, they chatter senseless gibberish by the hour and are quite happy because they're making believe to speak French. When children are together, even a meal is felt as an interruption in the business of life, and they must find some imaginative sanction and tell themselves some sort of story to account for, to colour, to render entertaining the simple processes of eating and drinking. What wonderful fancies I have evolved out of the pattern upon teacups. from which there followed a code of rules and a whole world of excitement until tea drinking began to take rank as a game. When my cousin and I took our porridge of a morning, we had a device to enliven the course of the meal. He ate his with sugar and explained it to be a country continually buried under snow. I took mine with milk and explained it to be a country suffering gradual inundation. You can imagine us exchanging bulletins, how here was an island still unsubmerged, here a valley not yet covered with snow. What inventions were made, how his population lived in cabins on perches and travelled on stilts, and how mine was always in boats. How the interest grew furious as the last corner of safe ground was cut off on all sides and grew smaller every moment. And how, in fine, the food was of altogether secondary importance and might even have been nauseous so long as we seasoned it with these dreams. Is it right, then, that... This is me talking now. Is it right, then, that we adults drag the children from this child's play into the world of reality and strict moral accountability? Stevenson agrees with Wordsworth that to do so would be to impose an adult's standard onto children who are living on a completely different level. Whatever we are to expect at the hands of children, Stevenson adds, it should not be any peddling exactitude about matters of fact. They walk in a vain show and among mists and rainbows. They are passionate after dreams and unconcerned about realities. Speech is a different art, not wholly learned, and there is nothing in their own tastes or purposes to teach them what we mean by abstract truthfulness. You do not consider how little the child sees, or how swift he is to weave what he has seen into bewildering fiction, and that he cares no more for what you call truth than you for a gingerbread dragoon. And so, why rip the children away from this wholesome world into the calculating world of adulthood, where sure enough they will spend enough time later on? Here's how Stevenson concludes. It would be easy to leave them in their native cloudland, where they figure so prettily, pretty like flowers and innocent like dogs. They will come out of their gardens soon enough and have to go into offices and the witness box. Spare them yet a while, O conscientious parent. Let them doze among their playthings yet a little. For who knows what a rough, warfaring existence lies before them in the future?
Sous la mousse. sont pas plus grands que les maçons.
C'est les rêves qui font grandir les enfants. C'est les rêves qui les poussent en avant, mais pas trop pourtant.
Dors à ta lente, tu seras savant.
We followed the reading from Stevenson's Child's Play with a fabulette by Anne Sylvestre, Berceuse pour rêver, a lullaby for dreaming. C'est les rêves qui font grandir les enfants. C'est les rêves qui les poussent tout en avant, mais pas trop pourtant. It's dreams that make children grow, that help them advance, but not yet too much. Anne Sylvestre has the knack of catching the child's delicacy and wonder here. And of course it's right to try to be with children in their wonder, but there will be times when we cannot move that close to their world, and times when we simply cannot be there with them. What then? Then I suppose we just turn to ask some higher power to take them into care. What more can love do? Bob Dylan offers us a clue. For his age, he's wise. He's got his mother's eyes. There's gladness in his heart. He's young and he's wild. My only prayer is if I can't be there, Lord, protect my child. As his youth now unfolds, he is centuries old. Just to see him at play makes me smile. No matter what happens to me, no matter what my destiny, Lord, protect my child.
For his age he is wise. He's got his mother's eyes. There's gladness in his heart. He's young and he's wild. My only prayer is if I can't be there, Lord, protect my child. As his youth now unfolds, he is centuries old. See him at play makes me smile. No matter what happens to me, no matter what my destiny, Lord, protect my child. While the whole earth is asleep, you can look at it and weep. Thank you. material things to touch. Lord, protect my child. He's young and on fire, full of hope and desire. In a world that's been raped, raped and defiled. If I fall along the way and can't see another day, Lord, protect my
child. That was Bob Dylan, Lord Protect My Child. You may remember that in Martin Scorsese's film No Direction Home, Maria Muldaur suddenly shifts from talking about her memories of Bob Dylan to singing a deeply impassioned gospel version of Lord Protect My Child. Reason enough in itself to see this excellent film. And you're listening to Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105, Cambridge's community radio. We're attending this evening to children. I've just said that we should try to come close to a child's wonder, but there are times when we can bring ourselves too close to children, or rather we can bring them too close to us. So close, in fact, that we see the children as extensions of our own identity. This is what happens, for instance, when parents push their kids to be stars in sports or drama. The child's success or failure is taken to be the parent's success or failure, and this creates a terrible confusion of identity for all concerned. Here's a story from Greek mythology to illustrate what can happen. It's the story of Niobe, the queen of Thebes, a proud, willful woman who wanted the whole world to attend on her. She invited them to attend in a different sense. She would brag that she had 14 beautiful and talented children, 7 boys and 7 girls, and had nothing to fear from fortune. When the women of Thebes came together for a public celebration of the goddess Leto, Niobe told them to ignore Leto and pay homage to her. With her 14 children, she was mightier than Leto, who had borne only 2 children, the twins Apollo and Artemis. Ah, yes, but what twins they were. Devoted to their mother, Apollo and Artemis sprang immediately to her defense. Being both archers, they appeared high in the sky above the playing fields where Niobe's children were practicing their riding and other athletic skills. One by one, they cut the children down, arrows through the throat, the neck, and so on, in gruesome detail we'll spare you. "Leave me one, leave me at least one of my children," Niobe screamed. Too late, too late. All were dead. And for Niobe, who defined herself through her children, there was nothing left. In her grief, she was transformed into a rock with streams of water flowing from it, representing her constant tears. You'll remember Hamlet describing his mother as, like Niobe, all tears. Well, it's a sad story, but these mythic transformations always have a deeper symbolic sense. Niobe merely became what she had been all along. She was always hard as stone. To see her children as extensions of herself meant that she had no love for the children themselves, always pushing them to excel in whatever they undertook so they wouldn't make her look bad. It's hard for parents to stand back from their children and allow the children to be themselves, but this is the only way to keep from turning to stone and to keep from smothering or abusing the children. And now, well, I'm going to present a somewhat disturbing song to you. It seems to bring us right up against one of the most horrible of crimes in our modern society, pedophilia. The more we feel distanced from our own innocence, the more we want to protect it in others. Yes, we're about to hear a Kinks song called Art Lover. And it is sung by a man who loves to spend Sunday afternoons in the park looking at all the little girls. But don't worry. I'm not a flasher in a raincoat. I'm not a dirty old man. I'm not going to snatch you from your mother. I'm an art lover. He looks at their pretty white legs like a Degas ballerina, looking like a work of art. Yes, he's tempted to come closer and wants the girl to come to daddy. But he restrains himself, knowing he cannot come closer. I'd take her home, but that could never be. She's just a substitute for what's been taken from me. And there's the kink. Behind this Sunday activity lies the grief of his own little lost daughter. Lost through divorce, death, we don't know, but here's another one of Ray Davies' songs about missing children. And so what is left? Very wisely, I think, he steps back to give himself what we call aesthetic distance, the kind of detachment we need if we're going to evaluate the beauty of a painting or a statue or a book or a radio show even. No personal attachment, no possessiveness, just seeing the other for what he, she, it is, which is just what Niobe could never do, and letting this beauty move us. And this keeps our poor art lover just this side of sanity and legality. Like Niobe, he weeps, yet not as a rock, but as a compassionate heart.
Something special, it's just like another world. Jogging in the park is my excuse to look at all the little girls. I'm not a flasher in a raincoat. I'm not a dirty old man. I'm not gonna snatch you from your mother. I'm an art lover. Come to daddy. Oh, come to daddy. Come to daddy. Legs, I want to draw them like a Degas ballerina. Pure white skin like porcelain. She's a work of art, and I should know. I'm an art lover. Come to daddy. And I'll give you some spangles. Little girl, don't notice me watching at better because I'm always wearing shades. She feeds the ducks, looks at the flowers. I follow her around for hours and hours. I take her home, but that can never be. She's just a substitute for what's been taken from me. Oh, come to Daddy, come on. Sunday afternoon can't last forever. Wish I could take you home. So, come on, give us a smile before you vanish out of view. I've learned to appreciate you the way our lovers do, and I only want to look at you.
That song makes me very sad, and I hope it makes you sad too, because it's a sad song. We can always judge the tenor of a Kinks song by attending to Ray's accent. Here he gives us his pure native London vowels, connecting this poor soul with his own childhood world. And don't forget that campy voice at a few points, which is unsettling, so we're not quite sure where we are. Now, sometimes, here at Evening Under Lamplight, it seems that once we start on the slide into the weird and macabre, we can't help sliding further, and I suppose that's what you'll say about the next two songs. First, here's Randy Newman's song, Four Eyes. The title itself is nasty. It's what I'd call an expressionist song, that is, it does not create a realistic scene, but an exaggerated, grotesque scene in order to convey a deep, twisted, emotional response to life. It's a story of what happens when a father is too controlling, trying too hard to get his little boy accustomed to the harsh realities of the world. One September morning, when I was 5, my daddy said, "Son, rise from your bed." I thought I must be dreaming. It's still dark outside. He said, "Son, if you fall behind, you'll never get ahead. Here's your little brown cowboy shirt. Put it on. Here's your little brown cowboy pants. Put 'em on. Here's your little brown shoes. Can you tie them yourself? Get into the car. We're gone." We drove, it seemed like forever, further than I'd ever been away from home. Then my daddy stopped the car, and he turned to me, and he said, "Son, it's time to make us proud of you. It's time to do what's right. Gonna have to learn to work hard." I said, "Work? What are you talking about? You're not gonna leave me here, are you?" And he said, "Yes, I am," and drove off into the morning light. For a while, I stood there on the sidewalk, a Roy Rogers lunch pail in my hand. Then I heard sweet children's voices calling, and I began to understand. They said, "Four eyes, look like you're still sleeping. Four eyes, look like you're dead. Four eyes, where have you been keeping yourself? Look like you've been whooped upside the head." Well, now, hear the nightmare as Randy Newman puts music to the words.
One September morning, when I was 5, my daddy said, "Son, rise from your bed." I thought, I must be dreaming. Still dark outside. He said, "Son, if you fall behind, you'll never get ahead. Here's your little brown cowboy shirt. Put it on. them yourself. Get into the car. We're gone. Than I'd ever been away from home. My daddy stopped the car and he turned to me. He said, son, it's time to make us proud of you. It's time to do what's right. Gonna have to learn to work hard. I said, work? What are you talking about? You're not gonna leave me here, are you? He said, yes, I am, and drove off into the morning light. For a while, I stood there on the sidewalk. A Roy Rogers lunch pail in my hand. Then I heard sweet children's voices calling. I began to understand. Listen, boy, look like you're still sleeping.
Yes, I let that fade all the way out. We need a few moments to adjust ourselves after that ordeal. So that's what it might feel like to a kid. Picture this kid grown up a little more. Picture him living in the ideal American dream, the wholesome world of Leave It to Beaver, the 1950s sitcom. All Americans know this family, June and Ward Cleaver. June, always immaculate in dress, necklace, and heels, even when preparing breakfast. And their little rascally son, Beaver, or the Beaver. Kids who wear glasses get teased and are called four eyes. Kids who have buck teeth get teased and are called the Beaver. Beaver's got problems before he even begins. But now listen in when, one morning, Beaver doesn't come down for breakfast, and June goes up to see what's wrong. We find ourselves in the world of Kinky Friedman's Something's Wrong with the Beaver.
She climbed the stairs that morning, found him rather pale. His eyes, they were the color of half-drunk gin. Faithful as a Magnavox, hung up on a song. She cried down to the breakfast nook, Ward, there's something wrong. A dreamer, never got it right, died and live in color, live.
box hung up on a song. She cried down to the breakfast nook, Ward, there's something wrong.
Something wrong with the people. Something wrong with the people. Something wrong with the people.
The middle of the lever is gone.
God, did the beaver just OD? Beaver died in living color, lived in black and white. Not just because he featured on an old black and white television show, but because he lived in that old black and white culture where things were all so clear-cut. You were either part of that white, goyisha American dream, or you were of no account. And he just wanted to dream in living color, as we all do. Beaver, I believe her, is gone. As is that whole falsely innocent world of Leave It to Beaver and its ilk. Well, gone except in the dreams of some political parties on the right. But we can't end the show on this note. We need something uplifting, don't we? How about the incredible string band? Like Donovan, who started the show, musicians who tried to recapture childhood innocence in their songs. Here's a very cellular song from the album The Hangman's Beautiful Daughter, a song that starts and stops, but gradually leads us off through fairy tales, biblical images, folklore, into the world of good night. And so good night from me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, on Evening Under Lamplight at Cambridge 105, Cambridge's community radio. See you next time as we fade off with the incredible string band's very cellular song. Thanks for attending.
Winter was cold and the clothing was thin, but the gentle shepherd calls the tune. Oh dear mother, what shall I do? First please your eyes and then your ears, Jenny, exchanging love tokens, say good night.
Lay down, my dear sister, won't you lay and take your rest? Won't you lay your head upon your Savior's breast? And I love you, but Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night, good night, good night. Lord, I bid you good night, good night. One of these mornings bright early and fine. Good night, good night. Not a cricket, not a spirit gonna shout me on. Good night, good night. I go walking in the valley of the shadow of death. Good night, good night. And his rod and his staff shall comfort me. Good night, good night. Oh, John the wine, he saw this sign. Good night, good night. Oh, John say I seen a number of signs. Good night, good night. Tell it for the art, that wonderful boat. Good night, good night. No, they build
and getting water to float.
Good night, good night.
Hotel before the beast at the ending of the wood.
Good night, good night.
No, it eat all the children when they wouldn't be.
Good, good night, good night.
I remember quite well, I remember quite well.
Good night, good night.
Now I was walking in Jerusalem just like John.
Good night, good night, good night.
Good night.
Come.